We are a Christian sex and relationships education program. So last week saw me stood in front of a room full of parents like this, talking to them about how to talk to their kids about sex and relationships. And one of the most intimidating gigs I've had so far was talking to about 150 teenagers about pornography. And believe it or not, standing in front of a room full of teenage boys and discussing pornography is less intimidating than this right now. So bear with me. I'm going to try and have courage. My day job involves travelling around the country talking about sex to teenagers, to teachers, to parents, talking about relationships, about how sex fits into that, and actually what do healthy relationships look like and how can we create a world and a context in which young people can achieve healthy relationships. That's my day job. My brief for today was to come here and say something about young people and revival, which is an enormous and terrifying brief. So as I start today, I am here as an ambassador for an army. An army of people who spend their days, their hours, their evenings, their weekends serving young people. And I'm here as a voice for a generation that I no longer belong to. A generation that is younger than me and generations to come. What I say today, I say as I stand on the shoulders of giants. And it's my job quite simply to stand there and recount to you the view from up here, from where others have brought me. So with that terrifying brief in mind, I'd just like to pray again as we start, because we need all the God we can get. Lord, you know the chaos that is my mind, you know the complexity that it is, that is this subject, you know the difficulty that the church faces. I pray that you would, in this tumble of words that will come out of me, speak to those in this room, that you would move mountains, that you would unblock wells, and that this would be the start of change today. Amen. I am not very perceptive. I just don't notice things that happen around me. It turns out that I've had numerous run-ins with celebrities throughout my life. I once caught the Eurostar with Gordon Ramsay. He wasn't on fire, I think I would have noticed that. But I was on the Eurostar with Gordon Ramsay. I've walked along the high street with one of Katie Price's husbands. And I did wander around my very small town centre at the same time as Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. And on not one of these occasions did I notice these people that I was very near. I just don't see the things that are happening to me. And I only know about this because people told me later. So it's entirely possible that I have met zillions of celebrities in my life, but people just haven't mentioned it to me. This year, M&S are selling a Where's Wally advent calendar. It's got absolutely nothing to do with Christmas, nothing to do with Advent, but it is great. And I was in M&S at lunchtime this week, waiting for a friend to buy her lunch, and spent 10 minutes staring at this calendar. And because I'm not very perceptive, I realised it would take me the entire of Advent to actually find Wally. So this is a message to my mum. That's the one for me this year. So with the brief of this week of talk about young people, talk about revival, seek the Lord where he may be found. I've spent this week wrestling with a game of spiritual where's Wally, or where's Jesus, perhaps more accurately. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Where is Jesus when it comes to young people? Where is Jesus when it comes to youth work? If you were to look into the papers for a depiction of what's going on with young people, you would get a very particular view. I love Have I Got News For You? It's my go-to thing to watch while I'm on the treadmill so that the pain doesn't kick in too hard. So I have a challenge to start with today. I'm a youth worker. I make people play games. This is a fill-in-the-blanks, much like they do on Have I Got News For You. This is a headline I've drawn from an actual newspaper, and I'm wondering if you can fill in the gaps for me or give some ideas. Young people are blank. Ofsted boss claims teenagers are not blank. Any thoughts as to what might go into those gaps? Young people are... Do shout at me. I'm perfectly happy with that. Pain in the neck. Young people are a pain in the neck. Anything else? Young people are uneducated. Ooh, using the Ofsted link. Anything else? Young people are
people are submissive and not louts.
Submissive and not louts. Okay, here we go. Young people are sloppy and don't dress or talk properly. Ofsted boss claims teenagers are not taught the right skills for surviving the world of work. Good news, guys. How about this one? Blank. I feel sorry for them. Brett Easton Ellis gives a damning analysis of millennials as he brands Generation... Okay. YZ. So, I mean, I'm being a bit cheeky here. We're talking about millennials. We're kind of bleeding into our upper generation here. But any thoughts? Why does he feel sorry for them? Any thoughts? How about this? Oversensitive and desperate. I feel sorry for them. Brett Easton Ellis gives a damning analysis on millennials. He brands Generation Wuss. The word most commonly used to describe teenage boys in newspapers was yobs, thugs, sick, and feral. A study found that around about 50% of the time that teenage boys were mentioned, it was in relation to a crime. If you were to look at the depiction in the newspapers, you really, really might have to hunt quite hard to answer the question, where is Jesus? If there's anything that we know from the media, it's this. Young people are a mess. They are a problem. They're a mess. Now, there's a story in the Bible where Ezekiel has a vision, and God takes him in this vision out to a valley filled with dry bones. And Ezekiel stands in the midst of death, devastation, dust, and God speaks to him. God says to him, Ezekiel, can these bones live? And as Ezekiel stands there, God reveals to him what he will do to these bones. He breathes life into them. He puts flesh on them. And the bones arise and become people. See, what Ezekiel sees are bones. What God sees is an army. The vision is incredible. And it was so tempting today to come and talk on that Bible passage. But there's a problem, because I've been standing in the valley and I do not see bones. I couldn't bring a young person with me today, but I want to introduce you to someone. His name is Suli. He studied at the University of Sheffield, so he now no longer properly counts as a young person. But while he was at university, he began to tear apart all his ideas about society. What did he believe about how our institutions worked? What did he believe about what our society said? And one day he wrote these down into a poem and he put it on YouTube. And this video went viral. Now, I was a youth worker at the time and I was going into school and I'd walk into the playground and the teenagers would ask me, have you seen this video? I showed it to my teachers. They were really annoyed, but it's amazing. Something he'd said had resonated with the heart of young people. And a little while later, he wrote a follow-up video. And I'd just really love to show it to you now, to give a voice to these people that we're talking about. When we're looking at the world of young people and we're asking, where is Jesus? Let's have a look and see.
Revolution on Represent 107.3 FM. My name is Tarek. Now, listeners, you may remember not too long ago, we had a spoken word artist by the name of Suli Breaks. Came down, dropped the live session, and a lot of you were excited about that. I was excited this morning when I opened up a package, had no idea what it was. Opened it up, put it in the player, pressed play, and it totally blew me away. It's his brand new piece from his brand new The Dorm Room EP. I'm going to have to let spoken word do what it does best and let it speak for itself. Brand new Suli Breaks.
Right now, there is a kid finishing parents' evening in a heated discussion with his mother, saying, why does he have to study subjects he will never ever use in his life? And she will look at him blank-eyed, stifle a sigh, think for a second, and then lie. She'll say something along the lines of, you know, to get a good job, you need a good degree, and these subjects will help you get a good degree. We never had this opportunity when I was younger. And he will reply, but you were young a long time ago. Weren't you, Mum? and she won't respond, although what he implies makes perfect sense, that society's needs would have changed since she was 16. But she will ignore him, grip his hand more sternly, then drag him to the car. But what she doesn't know is that she didn't ignore him just to shut him up. She didn't lie because they were just returning from parents' evening and an argument in the hallway would look bad on her resume. She won't lie because she just spent the last 1 hour convincing a stern-faced teacher that she will ensure that her child studies more at home. No, she will lie simply because she does not know any better herself. Although her whole adult life, she has never used or applied Pythagoras' theorem, pathetic fallacy, and still does not know the value of X. She will rely on society to tell her that her child, who has one of the sharpest minds in the school, is hyperactive, unfocused, easily distracted, and wayward. Students, how many equations, subjects, and dates did you memorize just before an exam never to use again? How many A grades did you get, which were never asked for when you applied for a job? How many times have you remembered something 5 minutes just after the teacher said stop writing, only to receive your results 1 month later to realize that you were only 1 mark short of the top grade? Does that mean remembering 5 minutes earlier would have made you more qualified for a particular job? Well, on the application form, it would have. We all have different abilities, thought processes, experiences, and genes. So why is a class full of individuals tested by the same means? So does that mean Sherelle thinks she's dumb because she couldn't do a couple of sums? And if this issue is not addressed properly, it then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Then every school has the audacity to have a policy on equality. The irony. Exams are society's methods of telling you what you're worth. But you can't let society tell you what you are, because it's the same society that tells you that abortion is wrong but then looks down on teenage parents. The same society that sells products to promote natural hair, looks and smooth complexion, with the model on the box half photoshopped and has fake lashes and hair extensions. With pastors that preach charity but own private jets. Imams that preach against greed but are all fat. Parents that say they want educated kids but constantly marvel at how rich Richard Branson is. Governments that preach peace but endorse wars, that say they believe so much in the importance of higher education and further learning, then why increase tuition fees every single year? I believe Miss Jefferson when she took me into the office and said that my exams would be imperative to my success, because we was taught to always follow when Miss Jefferson led. But then I took Jefferson out of the equation and learned to think for myself. I realized we was taught to always follow when Miss led. The irony. Test us with tests, but the finals are never final, because they never prepare us for the biggest test, which is survival. And what I suggest is fairly outlandish, so I do not expect everyone to understand this, except for the kids who knows what it feels like to be worth no more than that D or that A that you get on results day, and the ones whose best stories were never good enough for the English teacher, because apparently you missed out key literal techniques, did not follow the class plan, and the language was too informal for him to understand. But then he'd reference Hamlet and Macbeth, and you'd fight the urge to express your contempt by partially clenching your fist with only your medius finger left protruding in the middle of your hand, and then asked if he was aware that Shakespeare was known as the innovator of slang, or the kid at the back of the class who thinks, why am I studying something that doesn't fuel my drive? But then when confronted with a maths problem, his eyes come alive. So this one is for my generation, the ones who found what they were looking for on Google, the ones who followed their dreams on Twitter, pictured their future on Instagram, accepted destiny on Facebook. This one's for my failures and my drop, for my unemployed graduates, my shop assistants, cleaners and cashiers with bigger dreams, my self-employed entrepreneurs, my world changers and my dream chasers. Because the purpose of why I hate school but love education was not to initiate a worldwide debate, but to let them know that whether 72 or 88, 44 or 68, we will not let exam results decide our fate. Peace.
Where is Jesus? Passion, identity, community, purpose, world change, justice, hunger. Where is Jesus? Do you see bones? I see an army. Where is Jesus? Seek the Lord while he may be found. When I look at that, I see seeking. I see young people dissatisfied with the answers they've been given, dissatisfied with the future they've been sold, dissatisfied with the products they're told will complete them. I see seekers. They're seeking Jesus. They're seeking justice. They're seeking purpose. And where is the church? Because when they look at the church, they see none of those things. And if there is anything that should kick us in the stomach, it's that. I think there's a whole world of things that we could explore around why young people are struggling to engage with the church. And I just want to bring one today. Because that's all we've got time for. But I want to start with some statistics. In nearly half of our churches, there are fewer than five under 16s. That's in the UK. Fewer than five under 16s. A Tier Fund survey done a couple of years back said that younger adults, so those around about 16, are more likely than any other generation to have grown up with no experience of church at all and be absolutely closed to the possibility of entering it. They don't see the point. There was a Penguin Books survey done, and I'm just going to try and find it for you now. And it says, they found that 59% of children believe that religion has had a negative impact on the world. 60% would only go to church for a wedding or christening. The landscape is not good. Where is the church? This is a generation who've grown up in a world that is wildly different to ours. For the 14-year-olds of today, the 20th century is history. The attack on the Twin Towers on 9/11 is their birthright, and the recession is their future. Their home life is complex. Divorce is their family member. Technology is their parent. Facebook is their community. Instagram is their scrapbook. YouTube is their voice box. Climate change was their childhood companion. Justice is their middle name. Innovation is their hobby. Questions are their diet. Answers are just a click away. But trust and truth are hard to find. Relationships are transient. Sex is necessary. Loneliness is enemy. Happiness is their destination. Purpose is their quest. And religion is irrelevant. Where is Jesus? Where is the church? See, Jesus is present because his heart beats for justice. He's the God of innovation. He holds creation in his palm. He's the holder of the answers, yet the source of questions. He's the embodiment of love, the antidote of loneliness, the designer of sex, the healer of pain, the holder of the future. Jesus is still the answer to everything that's happening. Jesus still holds the future. Jesus is present. Young people are not finding him in church. We in the church, I fear, are deeply, deeply afraid of our own mortality. I think it's a cultural phenomenon. I did some research into the anti-aging industry, and it's truly impressive. If you want to make some money, develop yourself an anti-aging product because they're doing great. The number of Botox injections rose 680% between the year 2000 and the year 2012. The market for anti-aging products and services has grown by $99.9 billion in 5 years. We're not big fans of age. I fear the church has its own anti-aging industry, and it calls it youth ministry. There's a fairy tale which was made into a movie that tells of a star that falls to earth in the magical kingdom of Stormhold. As the star courses across the sky, the magical members of the Stormhold kingdom gasp a collective breath. Because you see, it's a well-known fact that he who possesses the heart of a star will live forever. And as the star impacts the ground in a crater, they grab their shoes, they grab their packs, and the people of the kingdom leg it out the door to find this star. Now, amongst the more dubious members of the kingdom are three hags. They've known power. They've known influence. They've known dominion. But they're staring their own death in the face. See, their power has waned. They know death is on their doorstep. And as the star falls, they realize they have one final chance for life. To find and consume the heart of this star. And so they set out on a quest, gathering the last of their energy. They fly out the door and they pillage their way across the kingdom of Stormhold, leaving devastation in their wake. Nothing will stand between them and their survival. They will find the heart of the star. They will take it and they will consume it. The star's name is Yvain. At the heart of this tale is a person fleeing for survival as people seek to consume her. When it comes to youth ministry in the church, I'm really afraid that the bride of Christ has become the desperate hag, clinging to its own survival, pursuing young people for the sake of their youth. Young people are the answer, are they not? Young people are the future of the church. They're the church of tomorrow. They bring vibrancy to the church. Our survival is dependent upon the revival amongst young people. He who possesses the heart of young people will live forever. And in its wake are left young people disillusioned by the church that they have met. Youth workers burnt out, broken, destroyed. PCCs frustrated and angry that the money that they spent has not paid off. And a church that continues to age. There was a Bible verse earlier that says, death has climbed in our window. Death has climbed into the window of the heart of the church because we have started to perceive young people as the answer to our problems, not as the people that God created them to be. Jesus told a significantly different version of this fairy tale. He only left us about two lines worth of story, so I've had to improvise slightly and fill out the gaps. And unfortunately, my knowledge of Jesus's time and place is a bit rusty, so you'll have to bear with me with the details and just trust me that this is a truthful representation of what I imagine Jesus said, almost word for word, perhaps a little bit different. There once was an office worker named Herbert, Herbert being a particularly Jewish name. And Herbert worked all day long in a dreary, dreary office. His hours were long, his job was soul-destroying, his office was bland. Herbert longed for a little bit more. And so on the weekend, he used to love to go to the marketplace in quest of the most beautiful things he could find. Pearls. And every weekend he would set out, money in his hand, to find the most beautiful pearl in the market that day. And one particular fateful weekend, as he entered the marketplace amid the hustle and bustle on the streets, something on the far side of the market caught his eye. A glint of light he saw, the most beautiful pearl he had ever perceived. And as he pushed his way through the crowd to reach that pearl, he gasped and stumbled up to the desk. How much? How much for that pearl? £2 million. I think they used pounds in those days. £2 million for this pearl, sir. And as he looked down at the £100 in his hand, he felt his heart sink. Do not sell this pearl, he said. And turning, he ran from the marketplace, returned to his home, gathered everything he could find in his arms, everything he owned, his clothes, his technology, his collection of beautiful pearls. He took everything and returned to the marketplace. Everything must go. Everything is yours. Everything. My house. Take it all. At the end of the day, his arms were empty, but his hands were full. And he returned to the desk of the pearl merchant. And he said, "That pearl, I must have it. Here is everything I own." As a church, sometimes I think when we hear that, we've forgotten what the pearl is. The pearl has become our survival. We really will do anything, give anything at any cost to survive. The pearl was really something quite different. The pearl was the kingdom. And when Jesus talked about the kingdom, he talked about the people who would be freed to live in it. The blind would be given sight. The lame would be made to walk. The kingdom is filled with Jesus' family, with God's children. The kingdom is not the survival of the church. The pearl is not that we would stay alive. The pearl, it's the people. The pearl's name is Cameron. A boy that I worked with, absolute nightmare, if I'm honest. ADHD, off the scale, could not sit still, didn't know what to do with himself, drove us insane, but kept coming back to youth group. At school, he was picked on because, in fairness, he was quite annoying, and the teachers didn't know what to do with him. But he kept coming back to youth group, and we kept welcoming him in, even though he gave us a headache. And after weeks and weeks and months, and possibly even years of him being there, we began to get to know him. And one day, as I sat with him on the pavement at the park, he told me his story. See, Cameron was in care and had been since he was much, much younger. But he wasn't an only child. He had siblings, and a new baby sibling just arrived. And each of his siblings lived with his mum. And as we sat on the curb and he kicked at the dirt, he said to me, "Why didn't she love me enough to keep me?" The pearl is Cameron. The pearl is Emily. Fantastic girl, beautiful girl. And as she sat across the picnic bench opposite me, she said to me with a shrug, no emotion, "I think I might be pregnant." Yeah, I'm 14 and he was 17, so I guess you could call that rape. The pearl is Emily. The pearl is Matthew, who sat in youth group, having come back from Soul Survivor. He's not from a Christian home, but he said, "I wake up in the morning now, and I know this is enough, because God is with me." That's the pearl. What would we spend for that pearl? Because we've been trying to get away with just spending a youth worker's salary. We think as a church it's enough if we can just pay a youth worker to do some of the work, they'll bring in the young people and then we will survive. That's how much we've been prepared to pay. Or possibly we'll have a Friday night youth group. Or we'll put on a Bible study on Sunday. But see, when it comes to Cameron, Emily and Matthew, I think Jesus paid a little bit more. I think Jesus was prepared to die. He paid with his life, and we are giving pennies. What would it look like if, as a church, we began to pay what Jesus paid? How much is this pearl worth to us? Is it worth a youth worker's salary? Well, I hope so, otherwise I'm going to be unemployed. But is it also worth more? Is it worth our blood, our sweat, our tears, our time, our homes, our houses? Is it worth our pews? Is it worth our church buildings? Is it worth our power within the church? Is it worth our secondary theological ideas that we're determined to ram down their throats, even if they don't want to listen? How much are these young people worth? How much will we pay? See, I don't think there's an easy answer to the question of young people in revival. I honestly don't. It's ridiculously complicated, and if it was easy, I'd have made millions selling it. But see, here's the thing. The first thing is to see that Jesus is already there. Jesus had this crazy habit of wandering out of the temple, and people, he'd disappear off, and people would try and find him, and he'd be somewhere out in the dust and the dirt. He'd be in the streets, he'd be in the parties, and the religious people would catch up about 3 weeks later and be like, oh, you're over there, oh, hi. He's done it again. He's already there. He's inviting us to join him in the world of young people. But he's challenging us to let go of our fear for the future of the church. Because he never promised us that young people would save the church. He said he's got that one covered. Stop making it their job. We're not a church that fears death, because we have a savior who went there and came back. We don't need to fear that the church will die. That's not our job. That's Jesus' job. Our job is the Great Commission. Our job is to go out and make disciples. But how much will we spend doing that? For those young people who have so many questions, such complicated lives, such difficult stuff going on, what will we spend? Because they've known cheap advertising. They've known cheap relationships. They've not known what it is to be died for. I want to end with the words of a youth worker in the States. He was asked, why do you keep doing youth work? Why, when it's so hard, when you see so little fruit, when you spend night after night out with young people, why do you do it? He said this, do you know what? Although it's pricey, it's the best seat in the kingdom. I believe that young people are looking for something more than what they have. And I believe the church knows where they can find it. We just need to change how we approach them, how our hearts relate to God. And then we need to go with arms open wide, prepared to spend everything that we have. Thank you.